Our next case is number 04-1771, the United States against Virgil Smith. Mr. O'Malley.
Your Honors, may it please the Court, Counsel, good morning. Your Honor, the District Court erred when it determined that Virgil Smith could not plead guilty to the charge of unarmed bank robbery. The Court was relying on United States v. Gray, a 1971 case from the Ninth Circuit, when it held that Smith may not plead guilty to unarmed bank robbery without the government's consent because that is not the charge brought against him.
Mr. O'Malley, there are two questions I have for you about this. One of them is, what difference does it make? I mean, you seem to think that he would have gotten an acceptance of responsibility adjustment. The government contests that, and I have to say, since it would have been put to its burden of trial on the armed bank robbery charge, it seems to me they've got a lot of force to this objection. And, secondly, they indicate that their fear isn't really the single prosecution. If that had been resolved in the umbrella of one case, no double jeopardy issue, I think is quite clear. But they mentioned in their brief, but what if the other charges had washed out somehow? If jeopardy had attached on the lesser offense, there would have been a serious issue in going ahead and prosecuting the greater.
Yes,
if there had been a need for a new proceeding.
Yes, Your Honor. First, as to the issue of what difference does it make. If the court was, in fact, in error, it's Smith's position that, look, the charge of unarmed bank robbery is specifically contained in the indictment. It's written there.
I understand that, but if the government was put to its proof on the charge of armed bank robbery, which is subpart D,
yes,
I know
Your
Honor. The indictment mentions A and it mentions D, so suppose you're right. Suppose it's exactly like that. But in the ultimate application of the sentencing guidelines, and we'll put to one side all the issues swirling around them, it's the greater of the offenses of conviction anyway that would have governed his sentence. And if the government had been put to the burden of trying him, where does 3E come in?
Well, Your Honor, 3E1 says, I don't have the statute exactly in front of me, Your Honor, or the United States sentencing guidelines precisely in front of me, but they say that if he admits, if he accepts responsibility.
But he didn't
he
on
would
the armed
have,
bank robbery.
Correct. But my point is he should have gotten a 2-point reduction because the government would have only had to prove the use of the gun. That's the government would not have had to prove FDIC insurance. The government would not have had to prove that the bank was robbed. The government would not have had to prove that Smith participated in that robbery in some way. All they would have had to prove was the use of the gun.
But you're in a sense saying that you get a 3E1.1 adjustment every time there's a stipulation, and I'm not sure that's right because you're saying that the plea of guilty to the unarmed is functionally a stipulation.
I'm saying, Your Honor, that it is, and I see Your Honor's point. You're saying it's a stipulation. I'm saying it's a plea of guilty to a charge that's specifically included in the indictment. Suppose, Your Honor, that Smith had pled guilty to aiding and abetting but did not plead guilty to armed bank robbery. He would have gotten a 3-point reduction then.
On the armed bank robbery charge.
Well, if he had pled guilty to aiding and abetting an armed bank robbery.
Well, I don't know. I mean, anyway. Well
thank you. All right, Your Honor. Your second question, Your Honor, if I've correctly recorded it, is that
the government argues in their brief that if the greater charge had been dismissed for some reason, perhaps Speedy Trial Act, which we can get to, or whatever, there might have been a double jeopardy problem in pursuing it if the plea of guilty had been accepted for the lesser.
I can't see how there would be double jeopardy, especially under Ohio v. Johnson. Smith has stated that he's guilty, and he cannot use it as a sword against the government to prevent the prosecution of the greater offense. That's clear under Ohio v. Johnson, and I believe it's United States v. Balin, which was decided by this court. So I think that the government is overly concerned with the probability or the possibility that there would be a double jeopardy issue, Your Honor.
Let me ask you something about the Speedy Trial Act.
Yes, Your Honor.
I apologize for not finding this sooner, but this court decided a case in 1986 called United States against Thomas, in which we said that a motion is under advisement as soon as the prosecutor's response is due, no matter when the prosecutor filed. Well, of course, in our timeline here, the government comes in about a week late or so with its response to one of these motions that's out there. And I take it that if that time is excludable, the extra time, I guess we're talking about between the 18th of September and the 26th, then you're going to lose on the Speedy Trial Act point. But if it's not excludable, then you would win. So I wondered whether you were familiar with Thomas. And
I am not, Your Honor. I obviously wish I would have been, because I think it works in my favor.
I'll give you the cite. It's 788 F. 2nd, 1250.
Thank you, Your Honor. But under a most conservative count, Your Honor, under my most conservative count, even if we exclude the time that the government wants for the late filing of its response brief, Smith still wins under a violation of the Speedy Trial Act, because the 70th day would have been the Sunday before the government filed its motion in limine, and that would have been the 71st day, which then would have told it. So under my most conservative count, if I've counted them correctly, the government would lose by one day.
Okay. Well, we'll just have to look at this clock carefully.
Yes, Your Honor. I think that while we're on the Speedy Trial Act, though, Your Honor, if I may address that portion of my brief, I think that there is an interesting question. At least it seems that the court took the position that it had the option of not dismissing the charges on this notion that the government would reindict Smith, and apparently that a grand jury would also reindict him. And, of course, under U.S. v. Taylor, 487 U.S. 326, that's a 1988 case, that is not permissible. The language of the statute is mandatory. we would concede that based upon the seriousness of the offense, the court would have dismissed without prejudice. And I will concede that the government, based upon the seriousness of the offense, would have more likely than not sought re-indictment. But I think that the danger we enter into then, which is a step I believe the court has crossed, is that the court has assumed that the grand jury is going to go ahead and accept the re-indictment. And I think that's something we have to avoid.
I mean, your argument has to be that this is in part about formalities, and even if it does consume a little extra time and delay Mr. Smith's trial, so be it.
Yes, Your Honor. I suppose it is formalities. It's also certainly his Sixth Amendment and speedy trial rights, too.
Well, except as the court points out, in this instance, his delayed speedy trial.
Yes, Your Honor. Your Honor, the other issue then that we have is whether the court erred when it determined that Smith could not, I'm sorry, when it admitted the Desert Eagle handgun. And I'd also like to address that. It is uncontested in the facts that the gun was never brought into the bank. It was never pointed at anyone, and it was never fired. The gun was left in the trunk of a co-defendant whose name in the record is Gennard Freeman's car. There was contradictory testimony over how the gun got there, but there was some evidence that Smith gave one of the co-defendants that weapon that actually ended up in the trunk of the car. At trial, I objected to the evidence being admitted on the basis that it was not relevant since it was not used in the bank robbery.
But that winds up with your argument about the escape portion of this. And there, as the government points out in its brief, there are a slew of cases that say that, you know, until you've escaped, you're not really done with the bank robbery. And I've seen myself plenty of cases where somebody's zooming off and escape, and at some point they stop the car and they can pull a gun out of the trunk, and, you know, it's a part of the crime.
I would admit and in fact compliment the government. It's an impressive brief on the issue of whether escape is part of a bank robbery, and it certainly is. I mean, there's no arguing that based upon the cases that were cited by the government.
So you're withdrawing that part of your argument?
No, I am not, Your Honor. Because there is not one case cited by the government where the weapon at issue was in the trunk of the car.
But what about my scenario? Well, you know, they find a secluded area, they pull the first getaway car off, they race around and pull something out of the trunk, and then maybe jump into another car. People do that.
That is a possibility, certainly, Your Honor, but it would mean that while in hot pursuit, they would actually have to pull to the side of the road, get out of the car, open the trunk, remove the weapon.
Right.
In order to use it. The cases that at least we have seen, and I grant your scenario is feasible, Your Honor, and however, in the cases that we have seen, the weapons were always in the passenger compartment or at least in the back seat of the car. There was no evidence, Your Honor, brought into trial that the gun was to be particularly used during the escape. It was placed in the trunk of the car, and it was, in fact, an argument that I raised at trial. Well, apparently they've abandoned Smith's aiding and abetting part here, that they decided not to go with his plan of using that weapon. That was one of my arguments for excluding the weapon. So since there was not one iota of evidence that it was ever to be used, to be removed from the car, to be pointed at somebody, to be removed during, to be available even during a hot pursuit, then, Your Honor, it seems that it would have been irrelevant. It would have been a violation of Rule 401 to
but
bring it in.
But at the other end of the transaction, I thought the evidence showed that at the beginning, as they're getting ready to go rob the bank, they put the gun in the trunk of the car.
That's correct, Your Honor.
Putting it there to be, it's not like they're about to go hunting or something.
They're about
to go rob a bank.
Your Honor, they did put it in the trunk of the car at the beginning. That was the evidence that was brought in at trial. There was, I think, some dispute over who put it there, and I don't think anybody pointed to my client as putting it there, but the question was whether he provided it.
Right, okay.
The case of the United States versus Bitterman, though, was a case where the defendant attempted to introduce evidence that he had purchased a 9mm weapon from one of the witnesses at trial. The district court and the Seventh Circuit upheld the judge's decision not to allow the admission of that evidence. The evidence, because the weapon used during the robbery in that case was a BB gun and not a 9mm. So they said, well, the weapon's not relevant. But how could we hold then that a weapon that was not used is not admissible in Bitterman? But in this case, we have a weapon which was clearly not used in the bank robbery, nor is there any evidence that it was used or even attempted to be used during this escape portion, other than its mere availability in the trunk, and then say that is somehow relevant. Your Honor, on the issue of the jury instruction, I won't belabor that. I feel that it is fully briefed by both sides. I would only say that we have these instructions which we use as our standard instructions. And when we take a statement which has been removed from a case and say, okay, this is now, we're going to use it as an instruction, when it was never used as an instruction before, what we're doing really is giving the government a second bite at the apple in closing argument. And it has the tendency, the danger is that it would remove the jury's focus from the instruction which correctly states the elements of the crime. I do not disagree with the government that escape is part and parcel of a bank robbery. There's no denying that. And finally, Your Honor, on the Blakely issue, which I've raised, I think we squarely have a Blakely issue here. The court enhanced Virgil Smith's sentence by 4 levels, saying that he was an organizer. The jury never found that. Certainly we have a Blakely issue. I identified the issue at
Mr. O'Malley, I'll have to ask you to begin to wind up.
Yes, Your Honor.
We'll hear now from Mr. Lanter.
May it please the court, counsel. First, concerning the issue of the denial of the motion to plead guilty to the lesser included offense of unarmed bank robbery, the government's position is that the district court did not abuse its discretion or step outside of its sound discretion in denying that motion.
But do we know the district court was exercising discretion as opposed to operating under a mistaken view of the law?
I believe the district court was under the impression, and as another one of the issues makes clear, took quite a while to decide the issue and was struggling with it in one sense. But I believe that the district court, according to its order, its interpretation was that it did not have the authority to, regardless of the double jeopardy issues, did not have the authority to allow a person to plead guilty to something that was not the charge that was charged in the full count, which would have been count one.
Which makes it sound like a legal ruling as opposed to the judge saying, okay, you want to plead guilty to part of this, but I just think that's a bad idea and I'm not going to accept that. You have to go to trial.
Well, I think the district court's position in its ruling was that it had no authority to accept such a plea because that was not the count that the person had been charged with.
But, of course, this indictment's a bit ambiguous. It does mention both subpart A and subpart D. I understand your theory is because subpart D incorporates by reference A, but it could be read both ways.
Yes, Your Honor. I agree that it could be read both ways, but at the very least, it's a single count that also has the charge of armed bank robbery clearly in there. As the government indicated in its brief, there are other cases where courts have held in a similar circumstance where A and D are charged in the same count that a person who pleads without a plea agreement to that is subject to the 25-year statutory maximum, the higher one, for the armed bank robbery. I think there's, quite honestly, I think there's different ways of charging a person with armed bank robbery. I think one of the government's concerns always is that they would be in a trial where a person is only charged with armed bank robbery and the jurors believe that he's robbed a bank but just that he didn't use a gun, and they're stuck with trying to reconcile that in front of the court and the jury at that point in time. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a couple different ways to cover all the bases in charging an armed bank robbery without losing an unarmed bank robbery charge. But the government accepts much of what Mr. O'Malley indicated about the double jeopardy issues, except in the instance which is indicated in the government's brief. If a person is allowed to plead guilty to unarmed bank robbery, then proceeds to trial, or the expectation he's going to proceed to trial on the armed bank robbery, and then any number of circumstances happen where the indictment is dismissed without prejudice, I believe it's unclear, or at least it's not sufficiently clear for the government's purposes in a case like this, that there would not be double jeopardy issues. The Supreme Court in the Garrett case indicated that remaining charges that were pending against the indictment would be able to go forward without double jeopardy issues. That raises the question of what if those are dismissed without prejudice and then there's an attempt to rebring them. In a case such as this, the government's position is it does not want to take any risk that a situation like that would occur.
It doesn't seem like a big risk, though, because there's no hint of the implicit acquittal on the greater charge in this case. And those are the circumstances where the court has said you can't get a second bite at the apple.
That's correct, Your Honor. That is correct.
I wonder if you could comment on this speedy trial point, which concerns me quite a bit. This circuit has taken a position that we want the calendar to be readily ascertainable, if you will, excludable days and non-excludable days. And so in this Thomas case that I referred to earlier, our holding was that the motion is deemed under advisement as soon as the prosecutor's response was due, no matter when the prosecutor filed. And if that were to be followed here, you're late. And the statute seems to be in very unequivocal language. It's written in mandatory language. The indictment shall be dismissed. Then you can re-indict if you want. You can do, assuming it's without prejudice, of course, which I'm sure, there seems to be no doubt that it would be here. So, I'm troubled by that. I don't know if you are familiar with this case or whether...
I wasn't familiar with it, but under the Thomas case, you're correct. The court's ruling, or however it would be phrased, would be late. And then the court would be faced with a situation of, does it dismiss the indictment without prejudice, or, and I believe the court on this issue ruled in the alternative, said if I dismiss the indictment without prejudice, then we're faced with the situation of the government going back to the grand jury, re-indicting the person, new trial date is set, and we come to trial even later.
But Mr. O'Malley concedes the practicality of what the judge said.
Correct.
But if the statute doesn't give you that option, then, so there's a legal question here. Is the option, the pragmatic option, if you will, that the court took, one which is open to the district court under the Speedy Trial Act, or do you just have to go through the process again?
Government would submit that, in this case, the district court did not err in doing what it did. If you're faced with the option of, if the court makes the affirmative ruling that I would dismiss this case without prejudice, and then it would be re-indicted, then the government's position is that you're to look to the effect of the Speedy Trial Act. If the effect is to be true to the exact wording of the statute, the defendant would get brought to trial even later than he's already going to be brought to trial, then the more prudent course would be to deny the motion.
Right, but the only problem is 3162A2 says if a defendant is not brought to trial within the time limit required by blah, 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 the statute, the information or indictment shall be dismissed on motion of the defendant. Now, lots of defendants fail to make these motions, but not this one, so...
That's correct, Your Honor, and again, this is sort of gelling or coming on the heels of the district court struggling with the motion to plead guilty to a lesser included offense. In any event, I believe that the error was harmless in this case, even assuming the district court did err in failing to dismiss the indictment. Mr. O'Malley brings up the circumstance in which we're not certain that the defendant would have been re-indicted or that the grand jury would have returned another indictment against him. Government's position is that we can be certain of that to the extent of the harmless error analysis. A jury convicted this person beyond a reasonable doubt of armed bank robbery and the 924C charge. The defendant gave a confession to much of the offense in the bank robbery, including that he approached other individuals, provided a firearm to be used in the bank robbery, helped plan the escape. And then there's testimony from three different individuals who participated in it. While you know, of course we cannot be absolutely certain that any particular grand jury will return a probable cause finding of an indictment against any one individual. I believe that in this case it would be harmless error, because very shortly after speedy trial motion is denied, the individual comes to trial. All of the evidence in which I just mentioned was brought before the jury. They found these facts beyond a reasonable doubt. I believe the court could conclude that a grand jury would have found sufficient probable cause, a much lower standard, to reindict the individual in that circumstance as well. So the government's position at the end of the day is, even assuming the district court erred in its moving to denying the speedy trial motion without prejudice, that's something the district court could not do under the shall language in the speedy trial statute. In this particular instance, with this evidence, the fact that the defendant was soon thereafter convicted beyond a reasonable doubt by a jury, that it would be harmless error. You know, I believe Mr. O'Malley indicated that the only thing he wasn't conceding was that a grand jury would have, in fact, returned the indictment. And obviously, with the vigorousness which the government pursued its responses and such to motions in this case, disregarding for a moment the fact that one of its responses was about a week late, that it certainly would have sought to reindict this individual. He basically planned a bank robbery and recruited either one 16-year-old and two 19-year-olds, or two 19-year-olds and one 16-year-old, two 19-year-olds and one 16-year-old to participate with him in that bank robbery. Again, a very serious case in which part of the government's evidence was that the defendant confessed to the bank robbery. Just to return very briefly to the first issue, government's position is that it would not have made a difference at the end of the day had Mr. Smith pled guilty to unarmed bank robbery. The government most certainly would have brought him to trial on the armed bank robbery portion. And again, setting aside all of the sentencing guidelines for a moment, just assuming they apply, or at least the acceptance responsibility portion applies, courts, at least in other circuits, have held that if a person pleads guilty, for instance, to possession of drugs, and then is brought to trial on possession with intent to distribute drugs, they should not get acceptance of responsibility for saying, hey, I was willing to plead guilty to the simple possession. In essence, saying, I had offered to take off the table at trial elements such as, were these drugs? Did I possess them? Unless the court has any questions, the government stands on its brief regarding issues 2 and issues 3 in the government's brief. One of the government's main positions is that escape is not separate from the bank robbery, but is indeed a part of the bank robbery. And the use of a firearm or providing a firearm for potential use during escape is part of the bank robbery. The fact that the firearm was in the trunk, I believe, is a fact that is not present in some of the other cases, for instance, the Pate case and others. But I don't believe that in those cases the court's rulings or reasoning turned on whether or not the firearm was in the trunk or not. It's very easy to imagine a situation in which, as the court has indicated today, the defendants go around a corner or are able to evade the police for just a moment, jump onto the truck, barricade themselves in, and then retrieve the firearm. Or as in the Pate case, even if it's in the trunk, it's aiding them and it's being used to embolden them or to encourage them. Finally, turning to the sentencing guidelines issue and questions like that, unless the court has any questions for the government about that, the government also stands on its brief with regard to that.
Thank you, Mr. Lander. Sir, your time had expired, but I will give you 1 minute if you have a point you'd like to make.
Thank you, Your Honor. Thank you, Your Honor. In response to your question, is it a purely legal issue? And I think that's the only time during our briefings that we had disagreed. I had taken the position that the issue of whether or not the the unarmed bank robbery was included in the indictment was a purely legal issue, and that was why I had it espoused or argued for the de novo review as opposed to abuse of discretion. And since I am limited to a minute, I would just say that I believe that when the government today argues that Garrett says the remaining issues, when it's talking about the remaining issues, I think the government is drawing too fine a line on Garrett. I think the court is saying, look, you can, I think Garrett is agreeing with Ohio v. Johnson. You can go ahead and plead to the lesser included offense and be prosecuted on the remaining issue. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. O'Malley. Our thanks to both counsel. This case will be taken under advisement.